We at DCP Entertainment have been honored to bring you season one of our podcast, Inner Space, with host Dr. Barbara Van Dalen. Over the course of 11 episodes, we've explored a range of topics focused on better understanding of our emotional health and well-being. We have explored mental health challenges for those who serve, our veterans, and their families, as well as the unique challenges and opportunities within the LGBTQ community. We've explored the impact of family functioning on our mental health and a range of techniques, practices, and opportunities that can help keep us all healthy. And in every show, we ask our guests how they take care of their own emotional health and how they take care of the emotional health and well-being of those they love. The answers have been inspiring, enlightening, and sometimes surprising. As a producer of this show, I love hearing what our guests have to say. And because of the show, I have been inspired to ask myself and others these same questions. And we are hearing from our listeners that they too love hearing these inspiring conversations. So before we completely close out this excellent first season, we are bringing you two bonus episodes of Inner Space. I hope you enjoy them. For our second bonus episode, we're once again across the pond in London, England, where our host, Dr. Barbara Van Dalen, presented the second annual Global Summit for Mental Health Culture Change. After many days of panel discussions with mental health professionals, celebrities, heroes, and everyday citizens, she sat down with summit panelist and UK police officer, Chief Inspector Michael Brown. They discussed the ways in which police officers are trained to respond to mental health situations in the United Kingdom, as well as the over-criminalization of the mentally ill and the ways in which the system is working to improve these conditions. We know you'll enjoy this important conversation.
I'm so happy that we're here this week in London for our second Global Summit on Mental Health Culture Change. And we've been visited by a huge number of amazing people who are doing incredible work in culture change, in mental health, advocacy, treatment, care, intervention. And today we're talking to Michael Brown, who is on one of our panels focused on the over-criminalization of the mentally ill. And Michael, I know a little bit about your background, but before we sort of get into some of the questions that I want to talk to you about, and thank you again for joining Inner Space today.
Pleasure.
But tell us what you do and what brought you to this panel today, and then I'm going to ask you a little bit to kind of go deeper into why that became so important to you. But tell us what you do.
Okay, so I'm a serving UK police officer. I'm a proper cop. I've done 20 years service, did most of my operational work in Birmingham, which is England's second city. And quite frankly, at the beginning of my career, they gave me a few hours of training. My standard joke about that training is that I now know half of that was wrong. Uh-huh. And I was then policing in one of the most demanding parts of Birmingham, where mental illness was everywhere. It was a very diverse community, a lot of poverty, a lot of social deprivation issues. And it just hit me between the eyes every single day as a brand new cop that this was a massive part of work I hadn't really anticipated, if I'm honest.
Can I ask you, you said, because that really struck me just now, that you had training, but it sounds like it wasn't really training that was helped you understand the constituents you were about to encounter and work with, that it really wasn't preparing you for what you were about to go into.
That's right, yeah. And in fairness to the UK police, this is the work I've done since, this is typical all over the world.
Absolutely.
Every cops everywhere say this, that they haven't had enough training. The police service, I suppose you could argue, didn't really think mental health was its responsibility in any way, shape, or form. And you will occasionally still meet a cynical old hand who might say, you know, this is nothing to do with the police. Therefore, if it's nothing to do with this, why do we need training? Why do we need leadership? But of course, the reality is it's a massive part of our work.
And why is that?
Well, I mean, lots of reasons. Apart from anything else, even if you think about the traditional role of the police or the, you know, what's perceived to be the traditional role around crime, people with mental health problems are victims of crime disproportionately. Suspects who are arrested and prosecuted for crime and imprisoned, they also have mental health issues of various kinds, disproportionately so. So even on our core police business, as some would conceive it, we're meeting people with vulnerabilities of all types. And of course, some people are victimized precisely because they've got a mental health problem.
Yes.
But then, of course, there's always then been that kind of saving life and limb side of policing where if someone's in a position of imminent suicide, whether they're on a clifftop or on a bridge over a railway line or something of that kind, who does society look to resolve that incident and get safety restored? Well, it's the police.
Yes.
Of course, what I think what I would argue is in the last 20 years since I've been an officer, the amount of work we have connected to mental health has gone up significantly.
Interesting.
And I think some of that is an inevitable consequence of some public policy. Huh. I think we've chosen, whether deliberately or otherwise, we've chosen to rely on the police more as a gatekeeper around mental health issues. We know that some people, for example, in Britain, there have certainly been examples of people deliberately committing a criminal offence in order to be arrested.
Yes.
Because it's an access route that they perceive to be better to mental health care rather than approaching the healthcare system itself.
And that's absolutely the case in the US as well. We see that sadly, that my nephew is actually a nurse in the jail system.
Yeah.
In the U.S., and I was just out visiting with him, and he's young. He just got his degree. He's a big, strapping young man, so he was a perfect candidate for this position in the jails, and they love him, and the folks who come in and out of the jail love him because he's very kind and gracious and thoughtful, even though he's a big, huge guy.
Yeah.
And he said, he watches it happen. He'll see somebody, they'll come in, they will not be on any medication, they're really, often really distressed, really agitated. They'll come in, they'll be stabilized on medication, they'll get fed, they'll sort of start to feel better, and then they're out, and then he'll see them come back in a couple of months.
Yeah. The revolving door.
Yes.
One of our major charities in Britain that looks at this is called Revolving Doors for that very reason.
Wow.
And they've done a lot of work, not just about mental health, but also the crossover with substance abuse, alcohol addiction issues and so on, which that the overlaps between all those issues plus crime are immense.
Are huge.
And therefore, that's a level of complexity about people that no one service is going to solve. The police service are not going to sort out in the long term somebody who's got addiction and complex mental health issues. But then for that matter, neither are the mental health services on their own going to do this. Of course, a major point that a lot of people forget is that in almost every jurisdiction around the world, certain powers under mental health law are reserved to the criminal courts.
Yes.
And therefore, on occasion, the criminal justice route might not be the right way to do things. If you and I were to design the whole thing from scratch, we might not make that to be the case. But given that it is the case in Canada and the US and Australia and Britain and lots of other places besides, if you make the criminal courts the sole controller of certain legal orders that balance off, for example, treatment, care, and public protection, then inevitably we're going to be seeking to prosecute people on occasion for offences when everything in the literature tells us that might not necessarily be doing very much for their mental health.
Right.
So there's a huge structural problem as well as all the practical issues about, in our two countries we've got, different kinds of healthcare systems providers. They throw up different challenges for the police forces in our two countries. I've had the privilege of going to some countries where, frankly, the mental health system is basically non-existent.
Yes.
And it throws up different challenges for those officers. I remember a trip to Namibia that was really eye-opening, speaking to Namibian prison and police officers about how the role they play in mental health care, because they, to all intents and purposes, don't have an accessible mental health system.
So they are the de facto,
they are the
if
mental
there
health
is
system.
Any system.
Yeah.
So... Again, I want to sort of go back a little bit, and then I want to talk about what your role is now and what you're doing,
because
it's pretty extraordinary, and you clearly are traveling around and both educating and learning. When I was a young psychologist, one of my first jobs in the U.S. was to be part of a mobile crisis team, and that we would go out with the police when there was a mental health call. And I remember that the vast majority of the police that we went out with loved having us because they not only learned with us, but they knew that we were there to help them make the right decisions about what was going on. So do you have those kinds of programs here? And more importantly, I think, is what... Because I don't know if you are unique in the UK, you personally, But I know that in the U.S., police who are like you are still unique in that they don't always see that this is their role or that their job. So it sounds like this is now happening more and more here, this sort of merger, if you will. And how is the police force here responding to that?
Right. So yeah, we call it street triage, which is a slightly ironic name because actually most of what it does is not triage, and most of what it does is not happening on the street. but nevertheless, that's the name it's ended up being given. What we know from these schemes, where we have often nurses in police cars with officers and they co-respond together. Sometimes the model is that the nurse will work separately and on their own, and they will respond to whichever frontline cops are at a job and work with whichever officers are there. And occasionally, especially in the more rural parts of Britain, it's very difficult to cover the geographies involved. So what they do instead, which arguably is not quite as effective, but it's better than nothing, is they place the nurse in the police dispatch control room and they work alongside the 999 call handlers and the dispatchers and they'll provide remote information or they'll telephone the person or the client and they'll try to do something rather than
nothing. So they consult remotely,
yes,
which is better than nothing. I mean, that's probably very helpful.
It is, but I mean, ironically, on the double crewed approaches where we could correspond in theory, most of the time they don't actually respond. So the nurses working with the officer will receive a referral about an incident, and they'll decide that they can handle that by just advising the frontline officers. So sometimes they correspond, sometimes they just remain wherever they are, and sometimes, of course, they've got two jobs going on at once, so they'll prioritise one over the other and provide advice to the one they can't attend. So there's different models around the place in Britain. The evaluations of these things are not great, but the point you make is absolutely right. The cops love it because it provides a very expert friend. And the nurses invariably have got access to the local mental health records of patients who are known to the NHS services. And what we found as these schemes have evolved is most of the people that the police service are meeting are people with known mental health needs who've been in contact previously with mental health services, or indeed are currently in a form of contact with mental health services, and for whatever reason, an incident occurred to which the police were called. The one and only kind of warning or caveat I would put around some of this, though, is in some of the areas, what we've found is that now the police have got the nurse capacity to be able to provide a bit of a mental health service. Other services which are struggling to manage the demand they would normally face are now pushing the work towards the police, not because they need the police specifically, but because
they
the police have got a nurse who can provide the help.
Yes.
So that it's one of the points I might hope to make in the panel is that if we think about criminalisation in terms of the criminal justice process, that's one way of conceiving criminalisation. But if you think about getting your mental health care in the shadow of the police, that's a different kind of criminalisation.
And it creates a whole different attitude and perception. So I have two questions I want to ask before we stop. One is, so your responsibility now, you are in a way are sort of an ambassador, right, of this kind of work inside the UK and also to other countries.
Well, indirectly, it's ended up happening. Yeah, I gave evidence in an Australian coroner's inquest into a fatal shooting.
I think that's how we kind of got connected.
Yeah, it was an Australian link, wasn't it? As I said, I've been to Namibia, but the main part of my role is I work for an organisation called the College of Policing and for an organisation called the National Police Chiefs Council, which is a kind of umbrella organisation for police chiefs. And the National Council have a chief officer who leads on mental health for the UK. He's my main boss, Mark Collins. And I'm his, if you like, right-hand man on all things mental health. So he has to run a police force as well as take that lead responsibility. So I do a lot of the work for his mental health portfolio. So my role is to write the national standards and guidelines for British policing, which ironically enough actually are based on a blog that I've been writing for about the last 7 or 8 years.
I've seen the name of the blog so that people might check it out.
It's called Mental Health Cop.
WordPress.com.
I started writing that on my own time, frankly born of operational frustration, because I just felt there was more to be done and said, and I wanted to put something up to the internet that not just cops but others could use. And I've had emails over the years from families and carers, individuals as well as other professionals, saying that they were grateful for some of the legal stuff, because British mental health law can be a bit of a nightmare, to be honest, in terms of how cops apply it, because as I made the point, we don't get much training. And once that blog had kind of taken off and achieved a bit of an audience, the call came through saying, can you come and be seconded to the College of Policing? So they've pulled me out of my police force. And for the last 4 years, I've been the mental health coordinator is my job title for the College of Policing and MPCC, turning the blog into national standards and the training packages. There's still more to be done, but
it's a darn good start.
Better than where we were 20 years ago.
And people who are listening to this, do go check out Michael's blog because it is very powerful. It is very informative, and I think it's opening up a whole new conversation in this space. The last thing I want to ask you, because you'd said, you know, before we started this conversation, you know, that you had no way of knowing that you were going to end up here doing this work. You saw the need and you started to address it, and now it's led to a welcome career shift. It sounds like you love your work.
Oh, I do. Yeah.
The work that we do and this program, this podcast, is all about our inner space, you know, how we take care of ourselves. Mm. Has your work that you didn't set out to do, but here you are, do you see a positive impact on your life personally and relationships with family and friends, given now all that you know about this mental health space?
Yeah, because I think my original reason for getting hooked on this as a topic was a bit of frustration about my own lack of training to be able to police the public when we had interactions. But of course, inevitably, once you get a little bit interested in that, some wonderful mental health professionals over the years have shared a coffee with me or frankly a beer and sometimes given me books to read. So my training's all been vicariously done in the pub, which is great. But where it gets you though is that by the time I finish reading all the stuff they've given me, you know, the sociology, the psychology, the psychiatrists have learned books and different kinds, indeed literature as well, eventually you can't help but become more aware of your own health.
Yes.
And I've several times in the last 5 or 6 years kind of put my arm in the air and said, I need to do something for me that's about my mental health and well-being, which is not a kind of, I'm in crisis, I need help thing. It's just a consciousness on my part that I need to take proactive steps, especially as I get older, to look after myself and to make sure that inevitably a man at my age, or any person of my age, where you're parenting and you're possibly married or in a relationship, you're pulled in 1,000 directions.
Yes.
You know, you've got to find time, as my doctor once said, you've got to find time in this life that you're living for Michael. Because
yes.
It's all very well being a cop, it's all very well being a dad, being a husband, being a friend, or whatever you are to everybody else. But where's the space left for you? Mm-hmm. And I've made damn sure that I forge a bit.
Well, and I think that's a great place to end this conversation, because you're pointing out something that if we all across society would help each other back way, way, way up and start thinking that way earlier and raising our kids that way, we'd have fewer people in crisis on the streets, wouldn't we?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yes. Well, thank you. And I would love to get back together with you again. I have more questions to ask. We're going to be sort of talking over the next, you know, several weeks and months about these issues globally, locally, and this is huge. This is a huge area that I think we are just now beginning to see movement.
Yeah.
So if I might, I'd like to look you up again.
Of course.
And perhaps sit down again when I'm next in London or when you make it over to the States.
I'd love to. Yeah.
Absolutely. Thank
Great.
You, Michael.
Thanks for talking to me.
The conversation between Dr. Barbara and Chief Inspector Michael Brown is truly educational. As a leader in his field, Michael Brown is literally rewriting the standards and guidelines for how officers could and should respond to precarious and often dangerous situations with citizens suffering from mental health care crisis. I am certain his work with the College of Policing and the National Police Chiefs Council will bring about change on a global level. I am so proud to be a producer on this show. I am proud to know Dr. Barbara, and I am honored to be involved in bringing her conversations to our audience and to those who are looking for ways to care for their inner space. Go to changedirection.org or follow at DCP Official on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to learn how you can be a part of our combined effort to change the culture of mental health.